Impact Leaders, the podcast on leaders focusing on impact investment and performance with purpose, supporting the companies that are solving the world's biggest challenges. Impact Leaders is brought to you by Fast Forward 2030 and Real Changers. Visit fastforward2030.com to learn how to include the global goals into your business models, and realchangers.com to find talent and careers with impact. And this is your host, JP Dahlman.
So in today's episode of Impact Leaders, we have Rodney Schwartz as a guest. Hi, Rodney. Welcome.
Hi. Welcome to you. Thank you for inviting me.
No, thank you so much for being with us today. As a way of an introduction, I'll say that Rodney Schwartz is also known as Rod, as people know him. He's the founder and CEO of Clearly So. And Clearly So is Europe's leading impact investment bank, working exclusively with businesses, charities, and funds, delivering positive social, ethical, and or environmental impact, as well as financial return. Originally founded in 2008, Clearly So has helped more than 130 clients raise more than $200 million today in impact investment from its extensive network of high net worth individuals and institutional investors. Clearly So is headquartered in London and is backed by Octopus Investments, Big Society Capital, and more than 40 high net worth individuals. Rod has had an outstanding career in investment banking and impact, and we will touch a bit more on his career a bit later. So let's start with a question that we are trying to help listeners understand more about. Rod, what is impact investing?
Well, I could be controversial and say impact investing doesn't really exist, that it's pretty much all investment has an impact. So actually, although it's a term we use and I use, in some sense, you could say it's a bit meaningless. Every investment has some impact, and all the companies in which investment is received generate some impact. Even mainstream companies generate impact. Some generate positive impact, some generate negative impact. Many companies generate both positive and negative impact. What we do as an impact investment bank is we intermediate capital into those companies that generate a significant amount of positive impact. But the key, JP, is to remember that impact as such is not some sort of segment of investing. It's really a third dimension to all investing. People think about return, people think about risk, and now they also need to think about impact. And frankly, they already are thinking about impact. So impact investing is a third dimension to investing.
Okay. And I heard you talk about that third dimension before, which is a very nice way to think about it.
We've been talking about it for over 10 years now because people initially wanted to make this a separate class of investment. And it really isn't that at all. It's a way people are starting to think about investing in the same way that 30 years ago or 40 years ago, people didn't think about risk as much as they do today. And then we had two-dimensional investing where people started thinking about risk as well as return. And risk, they used different measures, in particular volatility. Impact is much more complex to assess because impact can be of an environmental nature. It can be of a social nature, an ethical nature. It could be developmental if it takes place in countries that are much poorer and need economic development. So there are many, many, many more variables when you think about impact. That's what makes it complicated. That's what makes it fun.
Excellent. And you mentioned the word variables. So what variables normally do you look at, when you look at impact, or what we should look at?
Well, initially, we thought there were 27, I think, or 28 different types of impact. And the UN has 17 sustainable development goals. But within those sustainable development goals, there are different measures. So if we think about air pollution, lots of people talk about CO2 and reducing the amount of CO2 we use, but there are many, many other types of measures of air pollution. Similarly with all the other SDGs, It's the fact that there are so many variables and so many different benefits that makes impact investing maybe a bit more complicated, and why intermediaries like us have emerged, because people are interested in, first and foremost, whether or not this is a decent organization or company that they're backing, and whether they'll get their money back and maybe a bit of a financial return. But trying to understand the impact is something that you probably need a specialist for.
Okay. I think it's something that I want to talk about as well in another part, perhaps, but I understand that you actually turned 10 or 10 years old, we clearly saw recently. And I understand as well that in the last year, or there was a very short period of time in which you actually doubled the amount of funds that you have raised for the companies. And I was going to ask you a little bit more about that. What is it that happened? Or why is it that there's so much more attention to impact or impact investing?
Yes, you're right. We started 10 years ago, and just by a quirk of fate, it turned out to be the exact same week that Lehman Brothers collapsed. For me, it was quite poetic because I used to work at Lehman Brothers. Not at that time. I left Lehman Brothers in the 1990s, but I think there is something quite poetic about starting an impact investment bank, which is now Europe's largest impact investment bank, the same week that another investment bank I worked for collapsed. So that's the first thing I would say. It took us 8 years, I believe, to raise £100 million for impact clients. And I think, I suppose it took us a while to get started, but in reality, I think this whole area of impact investing was still something that people weren't really quite sure about, didn't really understand, were new to, didn't have little bits of their business that, frankly, were prepared to invest in these sorts of assets. But in the last 2 years, we've raised another $100 million. So it took us a quarter of the time to raise the same amount of money that it took us the first 8 years to raise. And at the pace that we're going, I think the next $100 million will come faster, and then the next faster and faster. I think that's partly because of our footprint in the marketplace. I think it's all, and I'd like to think it's because of some things that my colleagues have done very well, and I think that's true. But in addition, I think it's because institutional investors are now becoming much more interested in impact investment, and more than being interested in it, because of course, interest doesn't mean anything. It's only when you start to set up an organization and an infrastructure that is able to make these investments that it becomes relevant. Every large financial institution, and my background is in financial institutions, has to think about it. Probably some, you know, poor guy or gal has to write a paper, then they set up an activity, then they put it in a business unit, and that process always takes time. But what's happening is that more and more large financial institutions are doing that, and of course, they have trillions of euros or dollars or pounds of capital to invest. So that change is really critical. And a lot more of our deals are now institutional quality. Many, many more are of institutional size. So just to give you one statistic, in the beginning, everything we raised was from individuals, high net worth individuals. They're often called angel investors. Last year, we raised £65 million, and only £8 million was from individual investors. £57 million was from institutions. 5 years ago, that number would have been zero. So most of the growth has come from the fact that institutions are now getting quite excited in and getting involved in impact investing.
Excellent. And these are had another area. Perhaps I will not repeat some of these, but these are kind of the well-known names, or there are specific institutions that are targeting pure impact, or?
10 years ago or so, the field of impact investing, to the extent that institutions were at all involved, they were charities or foundations or a very few, relatively new, relatively small impact-oriented funds. they were never going to have the assets to really get this going in a big way, but very useful as a way to get started. Now it is about mainstream investors. It's about organizations like Partners Group in Switzerland, or AXA Investment Managers in France, or a handful of others, Lombard-Odier also in Switzerland, or some of the large Dutch pension funds. These are all household names in all of their individual countries. Sadly, I haven't mentioned any British names, because with the exception of really Palatine Private Equity, none of the mainstream firms have gone into this in a serious way yet. Barclays, I think, is trying to, so they're the first of the large banks to do so. In terms of large insurance companies, Prudential is doing so via M&G, and they're probably the first of that group, but definitely the continental investors, which are now making up a larger and larger portion of clearly so's investor base, are well ahead of the British institutions.
Excellent, excellent. And yes, perhaps worth noting or mentioning, so Barclays is supporting a bit of like the entrepreneurial side with Unreasonable and some of the other programs that they have, right? And I know that they have also a not to promote them, but I noticed that they have a kind of an impact investment side within the wealth management team, and I think they have a behavioral science team that is also looking at some of that. But I'm not.
Yes, we know the people there well, and they would love me to say that they've made great progress. I think the reality is they're making progress, but at the end of the day, to me, the only way to measure the impact of financial institutions is in the impact investment area is to look at what they're actually investing. I try to look past the announcements, the research, the conferences, the small programs. And I think these large financial institutions manage globally somewhere between $80 and $130 trillion. And if we're going to really make progress in this area, all I care about is how much of that money is moving in this direction. So Barclays and others have done some wonderful programs, but I want to see how much of their high net worth clients are investing in this area through Barclays, and actually how much of their own capital is going to support impact.
Excellent. And we'll talk about two things that perhaps, you know, are relevant to come back to this point.
And I'll be a harsh judge of them, not just Barclays, but all financial institutions, because I think as much as they've talked about impact, the reality is they are probably an obstacle in how capital moves from people with money to people who need money that are generating impact. So if I were to interview, let's say, Barclays' 100 wealthiest clients, they would all be delighted to have more exposure to impact investing opportunities. But financial institutions have been an obstacle, partly because they think that this area is one that they don't have much exposure in. So it opens them to legal risks, but also in many cases, and this is true of a lot of the private banks in particular, they're afraid that the assets will leave them. So I think that the reason they're an obstacle is for financial interest. I mean, I understand that. I don't criticize them for it, but I do think it's short-sighted, because I think that in the long run, if your clients want to do something and you're blocking them, they will do it a different way.
Excellent. Thank you for that. That's a kind of a food for thought, and actually, you know, a question perhaps that I'll take, you know, to one of them when I interview, you know, some of the banks that are, you know, trying to do but maybe not doing as much.
I mean, look, they've made progress, but I think it's not my job to praise them for the progress they've made. It's my job to make sure that our clients who are needing capital to expand and generate impact get what they need.
So just bringing it down to the actual kind of companies that are coming to you, and I know that you have an excellent deal flow, and you have, you know, many hundred, not thousands of companies coming per year. What characteristics, you know, do they have, and what, maybe here we can talk about also what size, you know, of businesses are they, when at the beginning, when they first come to you?
We do see a lot of companies in a year. We think last year we saw about 1,400. And given our capacity, we can probably only help about 50. So that answers that bit of the question. In terms of size, it's very important that the businesses that approach us have already established themselves. We don't do startups because there are many organizations in the UK that do a very good job and are dedicated to incubating startups. And we also think that after you go through that incubation period, that a good kind of validation of your viability is that you have found friends and family to invest in you. The earliest stage businesses that come to us are those that have exhausted that. And they're typically looking for 300, 400, 500,000 pounds. And that used to be almost all of our business. And now, as I shared with you, it's probably 10 or 20% of our business. Now, much more of the capital we raise is for companies that are making really good progress, companies that are becoming really very demanding in terms of the amounts of capital they need. And we will raise up to 20 or 30 or 40 million pounds of debt or equity. A good example last year was a company called Bulb Energy, which is a provider of 100% renewable energy. They raised quite a lot of money last year, and they raised an increasing amount of money this year at 8 times the valuation. So, you know, these are really really great companies growing really fast, generating a lot of impact and taking on incumbents in sectors that need a bit of shaking up. And if the utility sector doesn't need shaking up, I don't know what sector does.
Yes, yes. That's actually, since you mentioned it, I wanted to ask you about, okay, so we have, you know, the companies that actually, before I go there, I was just going to double check any particular incubator that you kind of highlight or recommend as a really good one for people.
I think there are so many excellent ones. And I think this is something that, whereas I was critical before of the financial institutions, I think the UK has developed a really good infrastructure for incubating enterprises. I think that I'm not generally in favor of tax incentives, but the tax incentives for investing into early stage businesses in the UK are already lavish. So I think there's plenty of room there. I think the kinds of companies that we're looking for are companies that are going to offer investors a good financial return, a market level financial return, however you define that, and also are going to change the world in some fundamentally positive way. As I said, it could be an environmental impact or it could be some other impact. But these are now the companies that we're looking for, companies that are less of the very social enterprises of maybe 10 years ago. They're no less social, but they're now much more commercial. And we also find in talking to incubators that so many of their entrepreneurs, whether they outwardly acknowledge this or not, they're really impact entrepreneurs. So in other words, even if they wouldn't say this, fundamentally, they want to make a positive difference in the world. And this is becoming almost the way many entrepreneurs just operate, millennials and all that.
Yes. So I may mention there that we, with Impact Founders, which is one of the communities we set up to help impact entrepreneurs, you know, we realized that kind of consciously or and sometimes unconsciously they are impact companies. So sometimes you explain to them and they say, are we really? And they never even thought about it, but they're actually developing a product or delivering a product, you know, to customers that actually is impacting the world. They didn't even set up to do it that way. Or
I think that's very interesting, JP, and I think that's a really good point about people who are the age of my children. My children are between 26 and 35. They may not consciously think of themselves with the sorts of labels that we're bandying about now, but to them, doing business in a way that helps society is just the only way to do it. And it's the only sort of thing they want to be involved in. So I think this sort of activity is growing in interest on both sides, both on the investor side, as we discussed earlier, and also on the investee side.
Yes, yes. I was going to mention about kind of follow-ons, right, and scale-ups, right? You mentioned bulbs coincidentally, and then the valuation as well, right? And I was listening to another podcast on startups during the weekend. I was listening to the founder of Social Capital in the U.S. His name, I tried to pronounce it properly, but it's Chamath Palihapitiya. So he has about, you know, 1.2 billion worth of net assets. He has Social Capital, which is, you know, trying to invest in companies that the ones that we are talking about. But he was very explicitly, you know, like you before, complaining about the whole model of inflated growth on the traditional investment funds and trying to, you know, show much more growth in the companies by injecting money to try to actually show more traction, to try to double the value to, for the series to come, so that, you know, the returns on the fund are better, et cetera, et cetera. Do you see any risk of that happening potentially on the impact investment side? Because it's just coincidentally as well, you mentioned about Bulb and how much you kind of double in price, but that's kind of one of how many, right?
I'm not really sure that I understand the point that that chap in the United States was making. And although I may sound American, I find America baffling, especially nowadays. But
so you are American-born.
I'm American-born, just for the record, born in Brooklyn, New York. But I have lived in the UK for more than half my life, with a brief stint in France and a brief stint in Germany. But I do find America baffling. Having said that, I don't worry about the focus on growth. We have not just Bulb, but lots of really great companies, IESO, which used to be called Psychology Online. So I guess you can figure out what they do from the name. Mm-hmm. Companies like Weeding Tech, which was a company that was involved in producing a product that did your weeding, but without chemicals. Or a company like Third Space Learning, which is involved in basically intermediating between maths tutors in India and math students in London. Those companies have all had very rapid growth and very rapid jumps in their valuation, and I celebrate that. I don't view that as a threat to the impact model. I think that that is part and parcel of what we're about, because the reality is that the faster these companies grow, the more impact they generate. So I think there's a positive correlation between financial return and impact. So I didn't capture the name of that individual, and maybe I didn't capture the point properly, but if he's worried about growth and the impact of growth in the impact investment area, I have the exact opposite point of view, which is the more growth we have, the better these companies do, the more impact we will generate, and more investors will start to focus on impact companies, and actually maybe companies that don't deliver positive impact, or maybe companies that deliver negative impact, will be under pressure because fewer and fewer people will invest in them. And in my view, that will make the world a better place really fast.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe I'll add a little bit of a, another angle to that question, or to that comment from the US, which was around, you know, we get investors, right, for the follow-ons, for the, you know, Series A, B, C's, etc. You know, in this case, it happens that in the US is more kind of impact fund driven, right, So if I take another angle to that question, I think the point was around as well, investors and venture capital approach, right? Where the investors come into the table, they put money in, but they start requesting, you know, growth so that the valuations can be such so that they can actually, you know, generate a return as an investor. And at the same time, obviously, you know, the managers of the funds, you know, get fees for the transactions, et cetera, et cetera. So that's another, I think, critique that he had.
But again, people who are making these investments have every right to expect a good return. And if it comes alongside faster growth and impact, it doesn't worry me at all. I applaud it. There were some early pioneers here in the UK, people like Doug Miller and Stephen Dawson, who advocated taking the venture capital approach and applying it to philanthropy. And it is a bit more aggressive, maybe. You push a little bit harder and you're less gentle, but I actually think charities need to be pushed harder because they have beneficiaries they need to serve. They don't exist for themselves or so that they can have cushy jobs. They exist so that homeless people get homes or people who are ill get cured. So I think the more aggressive, growth-oriented approach, a more demanding approach to charity or to investing in impact is actually very consistent with generating more impact. So I appreciate your steer on the question, but I still stick by my contention that this is a very positive development. We should all be demanding on the impact we and our investments create. And the growth will be consistent with the impact they achieve.
Good. Now moving to, you know, this is maybe a bit more kind of wider thinking type of question, and then, you know, there is no, I think, kind of right answer just yet. But you know, we do have these kind of huge challenges, right? You mentioned the global goals before, sustainable development goals from the United Nations, and you know, we have the news coming out, you know, last week around climate change, and then obviously that's on one side. We have these huge challenges that we need to solve for. And then obviously we have the startups, which are doing their best, but sometimes in terms of the total impact, right, is very small. And we have like organizations like, I was lucky enough last week to be at a presentation by the Nature Conservancy, and they were showing some of the, you know, incredible things they're doing with coral reefs and reforestation, etc. But then I was thinking, also, how do we do it to link this, to bridge these huge challenges and this, you know, great work we're doing or that you are doing, you know, with the startups and the companies?
Well, again, it's not startups. So many of these companies have been going 5 years or 10 years. And I think your question reveals what is very common in the venture capital or private equity industry, which is there is a very high focus on startups. In fact, I think there's an excessive focus on startups because startups are always very exciting because they haven't happened yet. So you can make all sorts of promises about what will be achieved, and then reality sets in. And actually, that's when we need to focus. That's the point of the cycle where we need to, a point of the company's development where we need to focus. We tend to focus on the startups and the very early stage businesses, but actually, I think we should focus far more attention on those companies that have made it for 5 years and they've gotten through, or 10 years. That's when they really have the potential, I think, to take off, because they've ironed out their problems, they've connected their ambitions with reality and what's possible, and I think that's when they need money. And I think one thing that I would feel for the UK venture capital industry and private equity industry is that they focus more on companies that are in a developmental phase. And I think there's a very significant pipeline of businesses that go everywhere from startup through to pre-IPO. And it's across the spectrum that I think people need to focus. The first part of your question, though, I want to really just reiterate a point for a second, which is, you are right. There are massive challenges, And that's another reason why I think backing fast-growing companies is really essential. It's not that the startups aren't doing wonderful things, but we don't have the time to wait for them to mature and develop. So I think we have to find those companies that are already making a difference and figure out how we can inject a bit of rocket fuel so they can grow faster.
And do you think that we have enough companies then in terms of, you know, what is out there right now?
I think there are more than enough really great companies that are generating significant impact. And the shortage, to me, without any doubt, is on the capital side. And it's not that there isn't enough money out there. In fact, there's more than enough money out there. But because of the structural issues that we talked about earlier, it's not set up in a way to invest in these impactful companies. And I believe over time, these impactful companies will generate at least the returns of mainstream companies. But we have to get around these institutional blockages.
We'll come back to that, but we'll start linking to that. So I was going to mention before as well, so that people understand also that you, your background and why you also know so much about banking, right? So you actually were a banker, an investment banker, and you were in many organizations. You mentioned you were at Lehman. I think it was for about 5 years, if I check the dates correctly. And then you actually were the head of financial institutions at Paribas, I think, which I think it was kind of your last role before you moved full time or completely into impact. And from that perspective, you know, with your experience and your knowledge, you know, you're more than experienced to perhaps share with us what you think would be like the financial instruments perhaps that we don't have today, or either we have today that we are not using enough, or that we don't have that we should be kind of creating to help these companies, you know. And I mentioned you before we started, you know, there are the impact bonds, you know, that I don't know, UBS is using with Optimus and the philanthropy team. There is, you know, Nature Conservancy with some coral reefs insurance, and there are some, you know, they're trying to do some public to private, you know, structures. So when I listen to all of them about what they're doing, everyone keeps saying that we still need ways to finance these.
Yeah, that's a lot of questions.
How do we get creative?
And let me comment on that. So I spent 17 years in the investment banking industry. I have to confess, I was not an investment banker for 17 years. Mm-hmm. I was an investment banker for probably 3 of those years when I was at Paribas. And at Lehman, I was running their equity business, so I wasn't an investment banker. For most of my career in investment banking, I was an analyst of financial institutions. So many of my observations are as an analyst of investment banks, fund management companies, banks. So I have seen other trends in the financial sector and how they've unfolded. And my view is based on that experience rather than as a practicing banker. From that experience, I would say that we're still in the very early days. And I'm going to be a bit controversial here. I think there's more than enough instruments available to do what we need to do. And I think that people who are coming up with unusual or different structures are probably slowing down our progress. I think that there is more than enough variety in the availability of financial instruments to generate enormous amounts of impact. As I said, I don't think the blockages are intellectual or structural. They're institutional. You mentioned social impact bonds specifically. They've gotten a lot of attention. They've gotten a massive amount of government subsidy, and they are proving to be ineffective. Very popular and very easy to talk about, but too complicated, too small for them to really take off. I think the basic debt and equity and convertible instruments that we have are all we really need at this stage of development. And I think if we concentrated on the sorts of capital clients needed instead of more complex solutions, the sector would grow faster. We've had social impact bonds. They haven't taken off. We had a social stock exchange that didn't take off. All these things sound really good. But fundamentally, we won't move capital, I think, as easily by creating these new structures. It will be much more easily done by using the tools at our disposal and just opening up these institutional blockages. I'm very sure that that's the case. And again, I base that on my experience as a Wall Street analyst and a London analyst of banks and financial institutions, and having seen many, many other sectors emerge and explode and things go really well, like mortgage-backed securities or derivatives or options, tracing their development back from the beginning, one sees it wasn't by, you know, creating a whole array of instruments. It was by concentrating on a few instruments that actually met people's needs. And that's where the growth comes from.
I like that. I may mention now, I've been reading the book from Ray Dalio, Principles. I don't know if you read it before, but he talks basically, Ray Dalio from Bridgewater, and he just basically studied the past and how we've done it before and what's happened before. And actually, then you can just realize that what is happening now may be called impact investing, and we are trying to label it differently, but it's just the same as before. And we just have to act and use this, the same principles again, right? That's what it sounds like.
I mean, that's one of the benefits of being old like me is that you have experience with other things that feel a bit like fads or trends, depending upon which they are. And you can learn from those and see how they are or are not similar to what we're experiencing right now. But one of the other advantages of age, I guess, is that you tend to study history and you find that all the things that you think are such clever, innovative ideas were things that were done sometimes 50, 100, or 1,000 years ago.
So perhaps just kind of finish, finishing around the kind of what can investors do, right, to, you know, help a bit more. So you mentioned that, you know, the split between high net worth individuals and institutional investors has kind of moved towards the institutional investors. You mentioned that, you know, there's potentially a lot more to do on the UK. Is there anything in particular that we can kind of ask or a call to action to, you know, institutional investors, you know, to be able to move these and to, you know, reallocate effectively, you know, the assets?
Well, I think from the perspective of your audience, I think there are a few things that people can do. So if anybody out there is thinking, yeah, this is all great, but it's very theoretical, what can I do? I think there are a few things. So I think if you are a high net worth individual and you want to back these sorts of companies, obviously, we would be delighted to have you in our network of investors at Clearly So. So one just needs to get in touch. And there are other angel networks that facilitate that as well. If you work for a bank or a pension fund or an insurance company or a fund manager, I think you need to try to make the case internally that focusing on the impact in investing, and I phrase it carefully that way, is something that will help your career in that institution and also in the long run will help that institution. And I don't think it will come with any financial sacrifices. I think the third thing you can do, if you're out there and you work in or for a government department, is just make sure that the tax system takes this into account. The tax system doesn't penalize companies that generate negative externalities, pollution, and other things as much as it should. And the tax system does not reward the companies that generate positive impacts as much as it should. And I think if we taxed the polluters or the generators of things we don't want more and gave some of that money to those people who are generating positive impact, we would probably save money, but we would have a much better environment in a general sense. I don't just mean in the sense of pollution. I think we'd live in a happier, cleaner, better world. but there is a lot of vested interest in the system as it is right now, and it's very hard to change. So if anybody has any influence, I would just urge them to try to see what they could do to change it, because I think it needs changing.
So I think I heard that on another interview you had. I think it was that you referred to it like the tilted tax or something like that.
I called it fiscal tilting, which is a really miserable name that anybody from a marketing standpoint would recognize. I'm not very clever at all when it comes to naming things. But I've been talking about it since 2008. And since then, there has been some move in this direction. Obviously, landfill charges and things like that. Clearly, some of the charges on diesel and congestion charges are a step in that direction. I can't believe it, but I find myself praising at least some of the ideas behind Michael Gove's latest proposals that farmers who generate things that are socially good, I forgot the exact words he used, should be given some incentive for doing so. That the way we pay out benefits to farmers should change from the way we're doing it to encourage things that are good for all of society. And I think that sort of thinking needs to go further, but much, much faster. I mean, this dribble of the odd idea isn't going to fix our world fast enough to address the problems that you mentioned earlier.
Okay. We'll call that one the Rodney Schwartz reform.
Well, that's probably a worse name than fiscal tilting, but if anybody out there has a better name, please send it in.
Some ideas. Yes. So we coincidentally, there are quite a few people that I've been talking to recently, and they're trying to actually go on the tax side. I don't like tax in general, but then when you put it that way, you know.
Well, nobody likes taxes, and people are.
Yeah,
I'm sure you do. But people understand that we need some taxation. What I'm proposing feels like something that would be very popular. So currently, we like to tax income, but we all want more income. So it's a conundrum. Why are we taxing something that people like? We should be taxing things that people don't like. So people don't like pollution. People don't like organizations that actually almost bring down the financial system, that create financial systemic risk. So we found a negative externality. We found out about a negative externality in 2008 when the system went down practically, and it cost us trillions of dollars to fix. That's a negative externality. And there are many, we have negative externalities when large employers like Walmart don't pay their people enough and pass on that cost to society. So I think when companies behave irresponsibly and do things that cause us all to suffer, that's something we should tax. And that's something that I think would be very popular with people. Obviously not the people who run Walmart, but I don't have any sympathy for them at all.
Okay. And just before we move to the last kind of two questions, I was just going to double check. I should have maybe mentioned it earlier, but in terms of returns, the investors are seeking or obtaining right now, what is the average that, again, inverted commas impact investment is yielding?
There hasn't been enough data to make a statement. We at Clearly So have probably done more deals than anybody, and we only have really about 6 or 7 years of data, but it looks like the returns are not bad at all, and also it looks like the risk associated with impact investing is less than with mainstream investing. I think it might be the attitude of the entrepreneurs. It might be the attitude of their investors that they support companies when they get into tough times, which they wouldn't do in companies that were not impact oriented. So I don't think we have the data. It's very clear to me that there are impact investments, as we've discussed, companies like Bulb or Just Giving or AESO, which have delivered stupendous returns. But I think it's probably true that on average, impact investments have lower risk and maybe on average a slightly lower return. But it's not a very significant difference based on our data. And I think that over time, I suspect that could become a positive difference. And there are reports that already suggest that impact companies might have a positive difference. But it's still too early to say that with any authority.
Okay. And on that point about around measurement, kind of measurement of return, you know, the data and or impact, is there any one place where people can try to go and find information? Or best way to do it as well, which is, you know, we talked about it before, but...
Sadly, there isn't any one place. There are an increasing number of academic papers looking at whether impact causes costs. And I think the trend of evidence is that it doesn't. What people are searching for is the Holy Grail, which proves that by investing in impact, you can generate a superior return. There is the odd report that suggests that. But I think in the interest of honesty, it's probably fair that it's still a more balanced view, which is probably there's no cost, but there's no clearly discernible advantage yet. If there was, the sector would really take off. And certainly this fiscal tilting would accelerate that, wouldn't it? Because it would mean that good companies would be receiving some tax credit and bad companies would be receiving a penalty. So I think that would tip the balance.
Excellent. Thank you. Now we'll talk a little bit about you. The name of the podcast is Impact Leaders. So we do talk about impact a lot, but we also want to talk about, you know, the leaders that are, you know, helping, you know, the industry, sub-industry, as you know, whatever we want to call it. And I know that you're very humble, you know, but you have had, you know, as per what I can tell and see, right, an outstanding career, a great career so far. You know, with leadership roles at major banks, you know, chairman NED roles as well at several organizations. You actually mentioned Just Giving, Shelter, and many more. And now, you know, kind of founded the leading impact investment bank in Europe, right? So, the question is, what does it take to be a leader and do what you do? And then I was thinking as I was writing, I said, what is the Rod's secret sauce? I never thought about it that way, but you know, I don't know if any of the two is better. You should see the faces he's pulling, by the way, in case you're just listening to this.
Yeah. Well, I'm just baffled by a lot of those comments. So I'm not sure that I'm so humble. If I was really humble, I probably wouldn't have started, well, two businesses. I think, obviously, I felt something needed to be done. And I just started. I think that doesn't feel to me such a humble act. And maybe I was ignorant. Maybe ignorance is one of the keys. When I started Catalyst Fund Management Research, we raised £40 million fintech fund. And I think if I knew more, I would have realized that was impossible. But maybe because I didn't know it was impossible, I just set out to do it. I think that if I thought more about the prospects for an impact investment bank, I might have not started. So maybe again there too, starting an investment bank was something that I should have thought longer about. It's taken us 10 years to really get to a point where we're now sustainable and thriving, and that's a long time. And I think if I had a secret sauce, it's only that I've had some wonderful people around me who have been incredibly supportive. In particular, some investors who've really stood by us when it was looking very gloomy. So my secret sauce is to surround yourselves with really nice people that have the ability to help you. In addition, Clearly So has had some great team members who have joined here at a time when they made a big financial sacrifice to do that. So I think the other element of the secret sauce is also other people, which is that they've come because they were inspired by what we were doing and decided to make a sacrifice and participate in what I think has the potential to be a tremendous and very successful, and in the long run, also a financially rewarding endeavor. But that is very much in the long run. And maybe, again, being not humble, the one thing I have been able to do is share a vision with people of how different and better a world could be, and been able to convince people that that was the case. Otherwise, the employees wouldn't have come and joined, and the investors wouldn't have participated. So, as I said, I don't think I'm humble, but I think I've had a very wide degree of experience, and I think that's pretty important if you're starting a company.
Excellent. So, okay. So it's being brave, taking action, doing it, getting good. Ignorant.
Maybe bravery and ignorance.
Hand in hand, hand in hand. And then, you know, getting the right people, the right team behind you. And is that one thing that you normally do or think about when you select, you know, your people, you know, your team, who you want to work with or to work
for? Yeah, there is one thing I do. On the employee or staff side, I always try to think about whether or not their joining our company would be a good thing for them. So rather than the traditional approach, which is if this person is good for my company, I'm going to convince them to do it, I try to imagine myself in the other person's shoes, knowing everything I know about Clearly So, and take a judgment as to whether, with all that I know, if I think this person should do it. I might be wrong, I might be right, but I try really hard to think if this will work out for that individual. On the investor side, I do spend some time trying to talk people out of it. I mean, I don't just try to sell. I try to be really honest with people so that they understand that this is going to be hard and long-term and risky. And I think by acting as a bit of a filter, it's meant that we've only had the right investors come in for the most part, one or two mistakes, and not big mistakes. And that has been really critical. So if you surround yourself with, everybody likes to say great people, but if you surround yourself with people that have an accurate sense of what the company is going to be like, and they then join, and they're talented and all that stuff. And if you surround yourself with investors who have an accurate sense of what the journey is going to be like, and they buy into that, then I think you set yourself up well.
Excellent. And you mentioned a bit of what some people call patient capital, right? It's for the long term. Is this any different, or people have to wait longer to actually wait for that return to come, or?
I think with many of the investees, investors have not had to be patient. Some of them have paid back very quickly. I think with Clearly So, which is intermediary in a completely new sector, trying to do something very different, I think investors have had to be patient, and we advise them of this right from the very start. We're trying to become a successful investment bank, which is hard. We're trying to do it on very little money, which is hard. We're trying to do it in a completely new sector, which is hard. And we're trying to do it in a way where we don't become all those horrible cultural things that investment banks often are, and not be as disagreeable as they are for the people who work there. So getting all that right is hard. And people have have been patient, but have had to be patient. Fortunately, now it looks like it's come good, but it did take 10 years. And my voice, although it may sound tired to your listeners, is not tired because of the 10-year journey, but because I had my son's wedding over the last weekend, and I'm still paying a little bit of the price for that.
Congratulations. I think your voice sounds great. So I'm sure that they will think so too. And if you, just to kind of close this section, this question, if you had, you know, either yourself, you know, when you were, you know, just your early 40s and making this big move, or you, there is another Rodney right now that is kind of about to make that move, you know, what is that one thing that you would tell yourself?
Well, I think I would probably tell myself or this other theoretical Rodney the same thing I tell my children, which is you have to do what you feel passionate about in life. If you don't, you will definitely fail, because you might be successful in one narrow definition of the word, but you will not achieve what you most want. And that will feel a bit like failure, even if you have a nice house and a nice car. You may still fail by doing what you feel passionate about, but at least if you follow your heart, you give yourself a chance of success. And I think normally, and this seems to be the case with many young people I know, when you follow your passion, you follow what's in your heart, if you can figure it out, then you do pretty well. And if you do something pretty well, generally success will follow. So what I would say to that Rodney is try to figure out what really motivates you and just do it.
And as we come into the end now, anything else you want to share with the listeners about Clearly So, you know, kind of the next 5-10 years, you know, what your vision is, and in particularly, you know, I think you mentioned before, you know, if investors are interested to come to you as well. How can people get involved or help you? Or,
well, obviously the temptation when given a question like that is to make this a commercial message. Okay. And I'd rather not do that. But if people have money they'd like to invest and they are high net worth individuals, because we're restricted to that group, please come see us. If they are skilled investment bankers and they want to make a difference in their lives and they don't think they're achieving it at XYZ, then obviously they can come see us. If they're entrepreneurs that have ideas that are going to be good investment ideas, but also might change the world for the better, or they know of people who have ideas like that, please send them our way. You asked about our next 5 years. I don't think our business will be very different, with one exception, and that's that we will be a pan-European firm. Over the last 5 years, we've mostly concentrated on the UK market. Now we're bringing in lots of investors from all across the EU. We will do that even if Britain leaves the EU. In fact, if anything, we're accelerating that. And in addition, we're starting to work with many companies in European markets. In particular, we're concentrating now on Sweden, Switzerland, Spain, Italy, and the Netherlands, in particular the Netherlands. And we imagine we might expand that list.
So, Rodney, if people want to get in contact with you, what's the best way, or with Clearly So?
If they want to get in contact with me, it's rod@clearlyso.com. And if they want to get in touch with Clearly So, just go to the website. And there are many ways to access us. We're very interested in inquiries that are relevant. We wish we could respond to the hundreds of inquiries we get every year from students who are interested in this sector, but those we can't reply to because we get so many, and we're a unique institution. There aren't any other impact investment banks like us in Europe.
Perfect.
So just get in touch.
Yeah, and I may also take advantage and share that you are creating quite a lot of communication as well and information on LinkedIn. So if people want to access to more information about Clearly So, the things that you're doing, and also the business itself, I recommend people to go and see John Loy, who is your
head of marketing.
Head of marketing.
Yeah, no, CMO.
He's publishing quite a few a post as well. So I would recommend that to people.
Yeah, I talked about not being like other investment banks. We're not trying to set ourselves up in a fortress. We try to be transparent and open and engaging. And actually, it's the engagement with people that really has contributed to our prosperity. People send us deals. People send us ideas. People also talk to other people about this impact investment field, and Clearly So. And that all helps move things along. So if anybody's desperate to do something, there's plenty for them to do. And all they need to do is get in touch and we can give them some guidance.
And is that what makes you different as an investment bank as well? Or
I think there are so many things that make us different from a traditional investment bank that I wouldn't even know where to start. But I think it's around the way we genuinely treat people, both the people that work here and the people we work for. Doesn't mean we're a pushover, we're professional, but our attitude is very different. And I think that makes this a very nice place to work.
And to finalize, is there any one last kind of call to action that you would like to pose to listeners, or a question?
No more call to action. I think that I have pushed it about as far as I would feel comfortable. I do expect that in 10 years, from an impact perspective, the world will look very different. I think that it will be very, very ubiquitous. I don't think this will be a narrow, interesting, quaint niche. I think that in 10 years' time, any large financial institution in Europe, even the British, will have an impact investment offering. And I think many large investors will have important impact components to their portfolios, and also will be measuring the impact of their conventional portfolios, because I think this 3D way of looking at investing, this three-dimensional way of looking at investing, will become the way we work in years to come, in the same way that when I was in business school centuries ago, we started to think about the world from a two-dimensional perspective. So that's a very big change, and I think given how badly my generation screwed up the planet, there's going to be a lot of work around improving it over the next 10 or 20 years.
So what are you doing as a listener, to try to help these next 10 years?
Yeah, I think everybody wants to do something. And anybody listening to your podcast will have a little bit of money, or in some cases, more than a little bit of money. And how you behave with that money is one of the easiest and best and most effective ways that you can make a positive difference.
And for those that don't have money, just your behavior, right? Just the way that you operate and behave every day.
Absolutely.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
This was Impact Leaders. Impact Leaders is brought to you by Fast Forward 2030 and Real Changers. Visit fastforward2030.com to learn how to include the global goals into your business models, and realchangers.com to find talent and careers with impact.